All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Torah Studies. So this is our weekly exploration of the Torah portion. This week's Torah portion is Re'eh, not to be confused with Re'eh. This is Re'eh. Re'eh, which means see. And there are amazing themes in this week's Torah portion. We're going to speak about one major theme that has likewise a major ramification, major implications for us and the way we live our lives. So please open up your Chumash to the Torah portion. You can find it beginning on page 1199. Now, what we're going to do is, actually the Torah portion begins on 1199. We're going to fast forward just a little bit. Torah portion of Re'eh has many, many themes. Talks about false prophets, idolatry, talks about laws of kosher, talks about tithing, talks about giving charity to the poor, and finally, we're going to talk about the notion of work. Take a look, page 1227. It's a long Torah portion. 1227. And here we talk about the laws of Jewish slaves. I know what you're thinking.
We have to take the statue.
Jewish slaves, what's up with that? So, yeah, Jewish law, Torah law talks about the idea of servitude, and it's not the kind that we're familiar with, I think. It's a different type of servitude. It's a type of servitude that the Talmud says that whoever acquires a servant for themselves acquires a master for themselves. In other words, it's a type of servitude where one is beholden to take care of the person that's working for them. It's basically like live and help, you know, kind of 24/7. I don't know, 24/7, but it's kind of live and help. If a person has only one meal, you have to give it to the servant. You can't take it for yourself, etc. In other words, you have to feed the other. I'm not saying forever. I'm saying that if there's an instance where you have, you know, only one food item at that moment, so then you take care of that individual before you take care of even your own needs or your family's needs. So the point is like this. The law states that when it comes to a Jewish servant, and by the way, how did a person become entered into this status? So the discussion is, the understanding is that if they, for example, if they stole something and they can't repay it, whatever, there are different ways in which a person could end up in this status. The Torah is telling us that the laws of how it's done, of how it works, and when they go free. And the big idea here is that they go free in the seventh year. 6 years they work, the seventh year they are released free. It's kind of like 6 days a week and Shabbat. The same thing is true with the cycle of the sabbatical year. Sabbatical year is a cycle, objective cycle of rest, and at that point, after that number of years, so then the servant goes free. Marnie, please. It's the same for the land. Well, the land is the Jubilee year. Well, yeah, the land, yes, the sabbatical year for the land. The land is not worked every 7 years, once every 7 years. The land returns to its ancestral divisions every seven cycles of seven, every 49 or 50 years. So that happens also. So that's the Jubilee year. And here we have another type of resetting, and that is when it comes to Jewish servitude, yeah.
But if they don't want to go, don't they put something in their ear?
There is an option to stay longer, but even then, there is a limit, an objective limit, where they are they're released. But let's take a look at the normative situation, which is discussed on page 1226 at the bottom. You know what? Might as well just read the... Sorry, 1225 at the bottom. Read where it says gifts to the Jewish slaves upon their release, Marnie, please. 1225, where it says, if one of your brethren...
I got it. If one of your brethren, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you by the courts, he should work for you for 6 years, and in the seventh year, you should send him away free from you. When you send him away free from you, you should not let him go empty-handed. You should give him many gifts from your flock, your threshing floor, or from your wine vat. Or you should give him from whatever God your God has blessed you with. Remember that you were slaves in the land of Egypt, and that God your God redeemed you. Therefore, I am commanding you today to do this thing.
In other words, just like God redeemed you, make sure you're redeeming the servant as well. Continue.
In the event that he says to you, I will not leave you, because he loves you and your household, since it suits him to be with you, then you should take a pointed tool and put it through his ear and into the door, and he will then be a servant to you permanently until the Jubilee year.
So there still is a hard stop. The Jubilee year is still even in this situation where the servant says, no, I like doing this. So you pierce the ear, you basically pierce the ear, and there's the commentaries explain why, because the ear that heard at Sinai God say that you are my servants and you shouldn't be servants of a human being, the person that chooses to be the servant to another human being, so you pierce the ear as a reminder to listen to God and not listen to perhaps your own devices. But either way, a person's ear is pierced, and then they remain in the household until the Jubilee year, which is not every 50 years on an individual count, but it's an objective count of every 50 years. So it could be toward the beginning of the cycle, could be toward the end of the cycle, but at that 50th year, at the Jubilee year, whenever that happens, he is done. Continue.
You should give the same adornment of gifts to a maidservant. Let it not seem difficult in your eyes when you send him away free from you, for he has served you day and night for 6 years, twice as many hours as a salaried worker who only works by day. God, your God, will bless you in all that you do.
And that is the conclusion of the Torah's commandment. God will bless you in all that you do. In the Hebrew, V'erach Hashem Elokecha b'chol asher ta'aseh. Okay. Yes.
Does this explain the diaspora?
Which part?
All the servants who don't want to stay at home will leave.
Interesting.
The servant who says, I want to stay at home.
Interesting. So you're saying that's why the exile. Interesting thought. I got to think about that a little bit more. I guess you could liken the collective Jewish historical experience to us kind of leaving the home, so to speak, and then needing to come back. Interesting. Let's focus on the very last phrase, the very last verse of that section, where it talks about God blessing you in all that you do. And this becomes one of the sources that relate to the concept of work, working for a living. That's today's theme. The theme is, why do we work? Should we work? How should we work? When should we work? It's all about work and labor. So the idea that a person should work for a living is sourced biblically, Jewishly, from this verse, that God will bless you b'chol asher ta'aseh and all that you do. What that implies is that the blessing is triggered by all that you do. So if you want a blessing, you got to do, right? Like Nike once said, just do it. Oh, wait, just do it, right? So just do it. So in fact, take a look. So now open up your Torah Studies text. You have a copy. Okay, so open up your Torah Studies text to text 1B. I don't know what page it's on, but you can tell me. What is it? 114. Okay, so Ray, please read this one. This comes from the commentaries. This comes from the Sifri.
The Lord your God will bless you. Perhaps this applies even if one stands idly. The verse therefore teaches in all that you do.
So the Sifri says, wait a second, read it in two halves. The Lord your God will bless you. Perfect. I don't need to do anything in all that you do. I'm on the hook again. Right? So God will bless you, but you and I, we need to do something to trigger the blessing. This becomes the source of the Jewish idea that a person should learn and practice a trade. In fact, it's even canonized in the Talmud text number 2. Jillian.
The sages taught in a beretta, a father is obligated to circumcise his son. to redeem him if he is a firstborn, to teach him Torah, to marry him off to a woman, and to teach him a trade. And some say a father is also obligated to teach his son to swim. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Yehuda said, any father who does not teach his son a trade teaches him banditry. Can it enter your mind that he actually teaches him banditry? Rather, the berater means that it is as though he teaches him banditry.
So the Talmud says like this, there are certain obligations that a father has to a child. Number one, bris milah to a son. You have to circumcise. Pidyon haben, a redemption of the firstborn if he's a firstborn. Teach him Torah to see that he gets married, and to teach him a trade. Some say also to teach him how to swim. Very interesting, very pragmatic teaching of the Talmud. To teach your kids how to swim, because otherwise, you know, what's it's a sakana, it's a danger. So, sorry?
In case there's another Red Sea episode.
In case, yeah, and it doesn't split this time. It's like, I thought it was going to work again. It's the worst. Make sure you know how to swim. Give me 1 second. So the Talmud is outlining various obligations, parental obligations toward a child. You got to provide for the child's basic spiritual and pragmatic physical needs, and one of them is a trade. In fact, the Talmud says, Rabbi Yehuda quotes Rabbi Yehuda, if you don't teach your child a trade to earn a living, it's like you're teaching him to be a bandit. As they say in Yiddish, a bandit. Right? What's a bandit? A robber, a thief. Why? So the Talmud says, what? If you don't teach your child a trade, you're teaching him how to be a thief? Basically, the Talmud says, yeah, because if you don't give your child a means to earn a living, so then when they get older, so what are they going to do? They got to make money somehow, so they're going to resort, perhaps, to nefarious activities.
Shiva, don't they do that?
Which part? Teach banditry or teach a trade?
If they don't learn a trade, they could, you know, study in a yeshiva. They wouldn't be a bandit.
So you're asking and touching on a very interesting question. The question is, so what's the deal with yeshivot that don't teach a trade? Right? It's like a long-term yeshiva. So let's keep on going into the text. Karen, please read text 3a. This is very... Oh, hold on 1 second. Question.
Yes. Why do only some say?
Oh. Where does it say some say? I see the sages say. Oh, some say. Yeah, Yeshomrim. Yeah, Yeshomrim. Basically, no, but think of it this way. Imagine you have a study hall filled with hundreds of scholars. And your job is to be the reporter of the discussion that's going on. So you're saying, okay, this is what's being said. Some are saying this. You're kind of reporting what's the activity in the hall. So when it's a collection of various sages, but you're not going to mention each and every one of them, maybe because there are a bunch of them, so you're throwing in some say. So that's what you're saying.
Some people disagree.
Some people that are actually adding on an additional, which is the swimming. So you have the core ideas that the sages say, the core teachings. So basically you have to circumcise, redeem the firstborn, teach Torah, find a shidduch, find a marriage partner, and teach a trade. Some say, in addition to that list, throw in swimming to it. By the way, it's not such a joke. We actually did that this summer. We had a few of our kids. It's serious, right? It's a serious thing. With two of our kids, actually three of our kids, we arranged some swimming lessons. One before he went off to overnight camp, and the idea is that it's, you know, certainly the one that's going off to camp with a lake or with boating or with whatever, if he doesn't know how to swim, you know, it's you can't rely on not a lot of fun, number one. And it's also, you know, there's sakana there. I mean, there's straight up danger. So we actually did that, and it came to mind, you know, at the beginning of the summer, this Talmudic passage from Kedushin. So here's the thing. Let's hold on 1 second. Let's do text 3a, because I feel like we have a question, another question that's kind of on the surface, which is, what about studying Torah all day? Maybe that avoids this whole notion of the trade. Continue.
Mark Spitz's father must have read this.
He was Spitz. He was.
He was Jewish. I'm
yeah.
Pretty sure.
And Spitz also means
how to swim.
Yeah.
Remember, he was the great Olympic swimmer.
Yeah. Before the what's his name? Before this guy.
Yeah.
Before Phelps.
Mark Spitz. Yeah.
All right. Text 3a.
sin to be forgotten. Ultimately, all Torah study that is not accompanied with work is destined to cease and to cause sin.
So let me explain. Rabban Gamliel says the following. This was not Rabban Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. This is a great scholar. He says the following: Yafeh Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. Torah study is good when it's coupled with Derech Eretz. What is Derech Eretz? Different meanings. Derech Eretz, huh? No. What did you say?
A path.
Well, it literally means a path, the way of the world. But Derech Eretz could mean manners, politeness. Derech Eretz means being a mensch, being polite. But the way it's understood by most of the sages on Pirkei Avot, this is Pirkei Avot from Ethics of Our Fathers, is that it means, Derech Eretz means having a job. The way of the world, i.e. going to work and earning a living. So Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz, when is a Torah study is good when it's accompanied by the scholar having a job as well. And the Mishnah continues. Oh, why? Because the toil of both of them causes sin to be forgotten. Keeps you out of trouble. If you're a scholar and you're working, yeah, it keeps you busy. Ultimately, Torah study that's not accompanied with work is destined to cease and to cause sin. Text 3b, please continue. Hold on 1 second. Text 3b, please continue.
All Torah study that is not accompanied with work is destined to cease, as the sages have said. If there's no flour, there's no Torah.
Do you know what that means? If there's no flour, ein kemach, ein Torah? What does that mean? Kemach, they used flour like we would use today, dough.
Yeah.
Literally,
yeah.
Dough. If there's no dough,
that kind of dough.
Yeah, money. If there's no flour, literally, yeah. If there's no food, if there's no money, if you don't have stuff, then you can't. If there's no flour, there's no Torah. If you're not eating, you can't be studying. Your mind is elsewhere, right? So you need gelt to keep on going.
The matter is to be taken literally. Joblessness leads to poverty, which leads to many sins and to great evil, for one will come to rely on gifts.
By the way, the notion of relying on gifts, the Talmud says, this is Rabbi Yonah of Gerona, he says, is a dangerous proposition as he continues.
He will resort to flattery, even of the wicked, so that they will provide for him. Furthermore, when the gifted funds are finished, he will become a thief or a gambler who takes from other poor people in order to avoid starvation. When a person reaches such a state, there is no stopping his spirit. He will not rest or be tamed until he transgresses all the mitzvot of the Torah, for one sin leads to another. Regarding this, have the sages said, anyone who subsists on his own toil, upon him can be applied the verse, if you eat the toil of your hands, you are praiseworthy, and it is good for you. You are praiseworthy in this world, and it will be good for you in the world to come. Therefore, a wise person must know a trade, as the verse states, wisdom is good with a heritage.
And heritage there is being understood not literally. Tova chachma im nachla. Nachla in this case means kind of like a path or a way, like a stream, like a nachla also can mean a river. It means in this context, with a vocation. So it's good to be wise and study Torah, but you also need a means for a living. This is also one of the very strong opinion of Rambam Maimonides. Maimonides famously writes in many places, several places, that it's incumbent upon a rabbi, a scholar, etc., to also have a means to earn a living, have some sort of trade, some sort of way to earn money, so that they are not susceptible to being influenced by the community and thereby slant their judgment. If you have a rav, right, a rabbi in a city that's relying on the people of the city, how objective can that rav be when people come with a dispute? You know, can that rabbi who's being supported be objective in deciding who is correct and who is incorrect in this court of judgment? So does it make sense? Yes? Now, the obvious question is, well, what about all of the rabbis that are just rabbis? And what about all of the kolels and the yeshivas that are just yeshivas? Okay, there might be other opinions. But this is definitely a very strong theme that we have in Jewish thought, that it's good to also have a vocation. Maimonides famously, of course, was not only a scholar, and he was a doctor, right? He certainly practiced what he preached. And yet you have other sorts of models. Famously, the Gemara quotes Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who about him it said, or the Talmud speaks about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and says that Torah was his vocation. Torato umnato. Torah was his, that was his work. That's what he did. The Talmud continues that many people tried like the Rashbi, like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, but didn't succeed. Not everyone can pull it off where that is their sole vocation, Torah. So for most people, you need a side gig, right? To get some money. You know, I also flip houses on the side. I don't know what I'm saying, you know, this, and, you know, we flip houses. I'm saying, you need something on the side. Again, I'm not saying I flip houses, but, okay. So that is, yeah.
So is there any room in here for, or is there any connection in Talmud between work or some sort of vocation and passion for that vocation? So the reason I ask that is because...
Should we do what we love, or should we do what pulls in the greatest gelt, right? I know you're asking theoretically, right?
Totally.
Totally theoretically. We're going to this will develop as the class goes on. So hold on to that question.
Okay.
We'll see how this develops.
What about
yeah.
the famous saying, you know,
no, not exactly. Right. Right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, love work and don't look for positions of leadership. Yeah, put your head down, do what you need to do and live a good life. Yeah, also be humble, but it's about working. There's a value to the work ethic. So and that's what the Torah says. The Torah, God will bless you in all that you do. Now, the question is like this. From a theological perspective, so if God is in control and God is the source of the blessing, so then why is it that we do need to go to work? I know that God says in the Torah, God will bless you in all that you do. But why? If God is providing the blessing, and moreover, we're approaching in a few short weeks Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. Right? So this Shabbat is Rosh Chodesh El, beginning of the month of El, and it's only 4 weeks later or so that Rosh Hashanah appears on the scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah, spoiler alert, it's around the corner. 5779 is basically here. I don't know the English dates. We can look it up after the class.
About the 10th or 11th?
10th or 11th? Makes sense, somewhere around there. Okay. So here's the deal. We're approaching the new year, and Rosh Hashanah, we know famously, we go to synagogue, we go to shul, and we pray. And we say that in Rosh Hashanah it's written, in Yom Kippur it's sealed, what will be our fate for the year. And we believe that part of that judgment that happens on the high holidays is how much gelt we're going to get, right? How much gelt we're going to receive that year. If that's the case, if it's designated on Rosh Hashanah and sealed, signed, sealed, delivered on Yom Kippur, if that's the case, so why are we working? It's already been predestined that we're going to get it. What's the deal? Right? So go to shul on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Pray for a lot of money. God will inscribe it because God certainly listens to our prayers. And the next thing you know, that's it. Just stay at home and enjoy the cash flow coming in. Yeah, good times. Let the good times roll.
One of the interpretations is that God puts it in the bank, so to speak. And then you can withdraw from it and they
on what you do. Yes, yes. So we're about to get into
that.
Take a look. Yes, that's a great way. So this is actually one of the major sources for this concept, where it's really fleshed out well, is text number 4 from Kuntres Amayin. One of the wonderful series of, it's a whole book that's one hemshech. It's a series of discourses by the 5th Chabad Rebbe, known as the Rebbe Rasha, Rebbe Shalom Tov Ber Schneerson. Take a look at text number 4. Who are we up to? Dan, are we up to you? Take away text 4.
The verse states, quote, "The Lord your God will bless you in all that you do." Now, why is such action and toil necessary to begin with, inasmuch as blessings come from God? If that's the case, let God's blessing come without toil and effort at all. Yet the fact that the verse states, quote, "in all that you do," indicates there must be deed and toil. The matter is even more difficult to understand when you consider the saying, "The of our sages that, quote, a person's livelihood is determined between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? If so, what need is there to work any other type of business or craft to earn money? Certainly the livelihood established by God's kindness will come to be, so why should we have to work?
So these are the questions that I mentioned before. Number one, if God is blessing, then why do you need to work? The Torah says work, but why? And number two, if it's being decided on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, then why are we working throughout the rest of the year? And the answer that's given, text 5A, speaks to what Sarah was talking about as far as us needing to do something. Yeah. And still there's God's blessing that's there. So in other words, we're trying to understand what is the interplay between God's blessing and our efforts. What is our role? If God's deciding it and designating and sending it our way, so what exactly are we doing? So take a look at text 5A. It's explained very nicely. And
there must be action on our part, which creates a vehicle for livelihood.
And vehicle, I don't know if I like the word vehicle. In the Hebrew it's levush. Levush means garment. Oh, sorry, kli. I'm sorry, kli. It's a vessel. It's like a container for that blessing.
This is one of the differences between work done during exile versus the era of Moshiach. When Moshiach comes, supernal kindness will flow with no effort or toil for livelihood on our part. But currently, we must work and create a channel for our livelihood. The reason there must be action on our part is because the supernal kindness must flow through the channels of nature. Therefore, man must also act and toil to earn a livelihood so that God's blessing be integrated into the rules of nature.
Okay, so here we have this idea that since we live in a world of nature, in a world of action, so we have to act to channel, if you will, we have to act to channel the blessing down. Take a look at 5B. He continues. If you don't mind doing 5B and 5C, this is where this idea is developed, and it's developed in a beautiful way.
The reality is that all these natural means are nothing more than a toy. The blessing flows from above through a certain vehicle, but does not flow from the vehicle itself, God forbid. Growth of crops is affected by the sun and moon. Yet it is readily understood that the sun and moon are nothing more than the messengers of God who have no authority to harm nor help, but rather can do nothing more than what they are commanded by God. A person's business dealings and natural means of earning a livelihood are merely an agent. The flow of sustenance from above is determined by of God. Blessed be He.
And there's one of the words there is wonky. It should be by the of, I think, is extra over there. So what's the message here? What he's telling us, what the Rebbe Rashab is telling us, is that God is deciding how much it is that we're getting. So all the work that we're doing is just creating a channel. It's basically, you know, slot machines, right? I think of you when I think of Vegas and the wedding, right? No, Marlene's son got married in Vegas, and we were there for the wedding. So
he hit the jackpot.
He hit the jackpot. <That's okay. laughs> He did. That's very nice. I'm glad we're recorded because we can isolate that and tear that on. So you know, if you're playing the slot machine, I'm not advocating for playing the slot machine, but if one is, right? So it's determined by the machine if you're going to win or not, correct? There's an algorithm, and whatever it is, it's a program in there. You put it in, you pull the thing, or you push a button, whatever it is, and it decides whether or not you win and how much you win if you win. Now let's say you won, and it's starting to spit out money. They don't spit out coin. What do they spit out, like tokens or something?
Coins?
Do we know what it does? Coins? Actual gelt? Quarters? No. Tokens. Oh, it's a card now? Ah, all right. But let's go back to the coins. I know, right? Yeah. Well, you know, I'm more of a poker shark. No, I'm not. Anyway, let's get back to this. So, but let's work with the. But let's say there are coins, because it's not going to work if it's a card. Cards are too. It used to be coins. Let's say it's spitting out coins. So what do you need to do if you want to get the coins?
Bag.
You need a vessel. You need a receptacle. You need something to catch the coins. Mm-hmm. What's the role of the bucket, the cup, the bowl? What's the role that plays? Simply, to catch the blessing that's falling, to catch the gelt. The bigger the basket does not make more money come out. You're with me? If you increase the size of your receptacle, of your vessel, it doesn't increase the amount that's coming out from the machine. The machine has already determined what you're going to get. You just need something to catch it. God says, I'm going to give this to you this year, but I don't want to do miracles, says God. I don't want to make it appear, you know, magically in your bank account. Do something. Give me an alibi. Give me some way that I can sneak it in, or that I can make it appear. Hold out your hand. Do something, right, that I can put that blessing into. But what happens if you kach means cook. What happens if you are all into the vessel and you forget about the source? So now you have a major basket. Maybe you have like a cooler size thing under the slot machine, but you never put in a quarter to play, right? You never put in a thing to play. So you got to focus on the source. Of course, you need the vessel, but the main thing is happening in the source. So we pray to God, and Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is a serious deal, and we do the right thing to generate the blessing from on high. And then we also need a physical receptacle, if you will, to catch the blessing. But that is certainly only catching what's already there and not creating it. That's why he says a person's business dealings and natural means of earning a livelihood are merely an agent. The flow of sustenance from above is determined by God, blessed be He. Make sense? The algorithm, right? The algorithm above with a capital A. Text 5C. One more.
It is thus understood that we ought not to spend too much time on the agent, for that would be a futile exercise, because one's goal is God's blessing, and the business is merely the agent. It follows that his focus should be on praying to He who truly possesses wealth and property, and on following the ways of the Torah, and the mitzvot so as to be worthy of God's blessing and kindness that were fixed for him through his acceptance of God and through his true repentance on
So here, the Rebbe Rashab kind of rounds out the discussion. Don't spend too much time. You have to spend time, but don't invest all your energy on the vessel. Don't forget about the source of the blessing, the source of the bracha, where that comes from, which is Hashem, which is God. And then he continues to say, there are a number of discourses, I think maybe 27 or 28 discourses. Each discourse has a number of chapters. It's a very thick volume. It's a very thick book of Hasidic literature. It's unbelievable. He continues to say that this is the shtut, this is the folly of the person who says, I need to go to work, I can't pray. I have no time to pray. He says, what do you mean you don't have time to pray? Why are you going to work? To earn money? Don't you realize where the source of the money is really coming from? It's like saying, I can't put money into the, like Lahavdil, right? This is not a direct comparison. I can't focus on putting money into the slot machine. I'm getting my basket ready. It's like, that doesn't even make sense, right? It's like, so you need, or the faucet, or the sink, right? You need to turn on the faucet and then put out a cup to catch it, but you certainly need to focus on the source first and foremost. So he says, a wise business person would say, I will precisely go to shul and pray, or pray, or whatever it is. I'll pray every morning and ask for God's kindness and blessing, and then the work will be the vessel that channels it or catches it or encloses it in a physical form, however you want to understand it, you know, with that, whatever type of analogy you want to use. But the point is that the primary is the blessing and the secondary is the vessel. Yes. All it takes, as they say in New York State, is a dollar and a dream. That's their line. Now it's $2, but who's counting? Okay. So that is a little bit about work. So the Torah says, just to recap section one. So the Torah says, God will bless you in all that you do. And the message that we took from that on a very basic level is, number one, that it's important to have some sort of vocation to earn the money, number one. Number two, even though it's God's blessing, that's the source, but God says, I want you to make a vessel to catch it, to materialize it, however you want to understand it, but you need to do something to make it tangible and real. So therefore, we have this duality. this the spiritual focus as well as the physical work as well. Now, let's take it a little bit further, because we're going to ask the question as follows. If somebody perhaps could find another way to earn the money, would they still need to work? Is there still value in doing the work? And the answer is yes. Text number 6. David, please read.
Man was born to work, but flying creatures fly upward.
Right, so if you're a flying creature, the second half is relevant to you. Otherwise, let's focus on the first half. Adam la'amal yulad. Mankind, human beings, were born to work. This is cited in many Jewish philosophical and mystical works to evoke the idea that the human being is designed to work and to feel good about working and thereby earning. A person does not feel as good to receive something for nothing, generally speaking, as one does when they get something as a product of their hard work. Does that make sense? The time, yeah.
What you were saying about, you know, doesn't it say, 6 days' work shall be done?
Yes. Yes.
Not 6 days you shall work, but 6 days.
Work shall be done. There's always a balance. So what Sarah's mentioning is that when the Torah says, Sheshes Yamim, what's the language? Sheshes Yamim. I forget the exact verbiage in the original. Yeah, but it's the passive. It's not you shall do work, it's work shall be done. So yeah, there are definitely texts that talk about the idea that the work itself should be done in a more secondary than primary way. On the other hand, it's all a balance, right? Because God's blessing is the primary. On the other hand, man was born to work. And as we're about to express, based on the Talmud text 7a and Rashi's interpretation 7b and text 7c from Ramban, the idea here is that a person doesn't appreciate what they don't work for. In other words, if he gets something without working for it, it doesn't feel as good. It doesn't feel as satisfying. It doesn't feel as rich. You don't feel as blessed as the stuff that you got due to your hard work, right? I mean, think about cucumbers, right? Cucumbers. You can go to the store and get cucumbers, but you don't feel attached to cucumbers. But when you've planted, when you've invested in it, and then they grow, there's a different attachment. It's you worked hard for it. And right? It's a big difference. It's a huge difference. You can't compare.
I know, so, because I grew vegetables. So yeah. It's a big difference.
So you know the difference. The stuff that you get. And even though you paid for it at the store, so it's not like you got it for free, it's not like a handout. You paid for it, but you're not attached to it. You could have picked up that one or that one. But the stuff that you've invested in, it's your baby. It's the product of your work. So this is evoked by that, by text 6 from Job. Man was born to work. Why? Because when we work, it fills us with a sense of satisfaction, a sense of pride, and a connection with that which with the stuff that we're actually earning. Text 7a. Steve, please read this one.
Rav Kahana said, a person prefers a kav, an ancient measurement of his own produce, to 9 kav of another's produce.
On a simple level, the Talmud is telling us, you would rather have less, but the stuff that you have grown, versus 9 of someone else's stuff. On a very simple level. Even though it's 1 versus 9, like, I'll take the 9. No, if it's yours, if it's your produce, you want one, whatever a kav is, a certain amount of, you know, area of stuff. You would rather have your one kav than someone else's 9. Let's skip 7b. Take a look at 7c. One more text, Steve. 7c from Ramban.
A person derives pleasure for eating of his own efforts and thereby fulfilling the verse. If you eat the toil of your hands, you are praiseworthy and it is good for you.
So if you eat of the toil of your hands, if you're enjoying the stuff that you have produced and created and worked for, number one, you are praiseworthy because you're earning your own keep. But number two, it is good for you. You're going to have more sipuk hanefesh, more satisfaction, more enjoyment, more it's more contentment because you have worked for it and you have earned what you received. Now this becomes the source for how we give tzedakah. Very long text, text 8. We're not going to read the whole thing through. You can take it home and read it, and you should read it. Maimonides famously describes 8 levels of giving tzedakah, of giving charity. And he goes from the lowest to the highest. And the lowest, as you go up the scale, he starts from the top down. Interesting, right? He starts from the top down. But if I were to start from the bottom up, I would say like this. What marks a lower level and what marks a higher level? As you go higher, it's not about how much you're giving. It's about how much dignity you're giving. It's not about the money. It's about the self-respect. It's about the dignity and the honor and the respect that you're giving to the other. Why? The premise of this is that that people by nature don't feel a sense of pride or a sense of, they don't feel good receiving from someone else, right? You feel good when you've worked and you've earned something. So to take from someone else doesn't feel as good. It sometimes hurts a person to ask for something, right? It's not easy sometimes to ask. The highest level of tzedakah famously is what? What's the highest level of tzedakah? Giving a job. Why is that the highest level? Because you're not giving them something. You're giving them an opportunity to work for it. And when they work for it and they get paid, they've earned it. It's theirs. They're not getting your 9 kavim. They're not getting your stuff. They're getting their stuff. They're getting the fruit of their own labor. And that is dignifying, right? That gives, that grants someone their dignity. So you can give them everything they need with a smile, and there's a certain amount of dignity there. Anonymously, even better, because now they don't, when they see you, they don't feel, you know, embarrassed or beholden, right? So that's a higher level. The highest level, though, is when they feel like they're not getting anything at all. They haven't been handed anything at all. Mm-hmm. What have you given them? An opportunity. But in the vacuum, in the space of that opportunity, they are investing their work. They're getting paid for their work. So therefore, they're getting what they've put in. That grants someone their dignity. In other words, the point of all of this is that a human being, by nature, is designed to work, because by working, a person has a certain sense of satisfaction that they cannot get without the work. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So are you saying that we should all strive to not have to pray for an opportunity?
Ideally, we find a space in which we can invest our passion, our talents, and get from that, or at least through that, make the vessel and allow God's blessing to flow through that. That is the ideal. Sometimes you need someone to open up a door that you can step in, right? So somebody gives a person an opportunity and says, hey, I'm hiring, and you say, hey, I'm looking for a job, and it's a perfect match. That's a great thing. So it's okay to take, if you will, an opportunity, or to ask for an opportunity. But the point of this is that the way human beings are created is that the greatest satisfaction is born of that which is a product of our own efforts. And this is not taken away from what we said before, that ultimately everything is a blessing from God. So ultimately it all comes from Hashem. That's true. But at least the vehicle, the vessel, the garment, right, the channel that we create for it, that is our investment. And the more we invest, and the more it's us who's doing the investing, the better we feel about the return that we're getting. And the more connected, the more satisfaction we have with it. Yeah.
And that doesn't discount the praying to God.
It's like I remember no, 100%.
Yeah. Like I remember that there used to be this thing of a boat in the lake. It said, pray to God, but row for shore.
Exactly. Exactly. You still have to row? Right. You can pray to God, but you still have to row. That's like the famous, you know, the famous story about the flood. You know the famous story with the flood, right? I think everyone knows the story. I'll say it again anyway, just in case. We've got to cover our bases. So there is a flood, and you have this guy who's a real believer in Hashem. He's a real believer in God, and he says, you know, they're evacuating. Everyone has to, mandatory evacuation. The flood, the levels are rising. And this fellow says, no, I trust in God. God will protect. Okay, so the sheriff comes by. No, I trust in God. The waters rise higher. He's climbing up to his roof. They send a boat, right? The city sends a boat. No, I trust in God. It's rising higher still. They send a helicopter for him. No, God will provide. No, at the end he dies. He drowns, he dies. He comes up to heaven. He says, God, what happened? I trusted in you. How come you didn't save me? He's like, what do you mean? I sent the marshal. I sent a boat for you. I sent a helicopter for you. What do you want me to do? So, but you still need to row. You still need to get into the boat. You still need to climb up the ladder to the helicopter. There is work that you need to do, but at the core, it's coming from the Abish. It's coming from above. That's the core, right? I mean, so this is the balance. In general, life is a balance, but particularly in this discussion, we have a balance. We're supposed to work, but it's God's blessing, but we still have to work. And the more we invest, the better we feel about it, but it's still God's blessing. Still God's blessing all the way through. Now, text 9a is again about tzedakah. It's about how to give in a way that is meaningful or that retains the dignity of the recipient. Let's look at text number 11. And text 11 now broadens this discussion away from or expands it from the topic of working to earn money, to earn a parnasa, and it broadens it to talk about earning our relationship with God. Earning our relationship with God. In other words, working to develop a relationship with Hashem, which then stirs and generates the blessings that we wish to enjoy. Sarah, please read text number 11 from Likudei Sichot. So the question that the Rebbe is addressing in general is, how come God doesn't just reveal himself to us, you know, on a regular basis? It would be nice, right? Imagine if God spoke to you. You know what they say. If you speak to God, you're religious. If God speaks to you,
you're crazy.
You're crazy. Right? So, but how come God doesn't speak to us on a regular basis, right? It would be nice. It would be nice if God spoke to us more often than the signs that we get otherwise, right? It would be very nice if God revealed mass revelation. Look, it was good to live back in the day. They had 10 plagues. They had a splitting of the sea. They had revelation at Sinai. They had a Mishkan, a tabernacle, where miracles happened on a daily basis. You could see God. It would be nice, right? So why don't we have this divine revelation? So the Rebbe, nowadays, the Rebbe says, because the greatest goodness, the greatest good is when you and I are earning it. And it's not that God is just giving it to us. So the greatest blessings are the blessings that are born of our toil, effort, and hard work. And those are the blessings that we appreciate and that we internalize. You see, if you get something without working on it, easy come, easy go. It's not internalized. You haven't paved the way inside to actually receive it. You haven't done the work, right? If somebody drops you on top of a mountain, and you're not a mountain climber, and you don't have the right equipment, it's easy to fall off, theoretically. I have no idea. But I'm saying theoretically, maybe you just sit down and you're fine. But theoretically, it's going to be hard to navigate because you don't have the tools. But if you've climbed up the mountain, it's certainly easier to be airlifted with a helicopter and dropped on top of Mount Everest, if that's possible. Is that possible? I don't believe it's possible. Because no one's doing it, right? If that was a thing, people should be doing it. Whatever. We'll get on that. Right, we have a very exciting group here. I'm just saying. Look, we are not mountain climbers. That makes sense. I feel like though, we can get on that. That's our next big thing. You know. Elon Musk. I was thinking about him, yeah. Or Jeff Bezos from Amazon. Let them fight it out. There you go. Right. So here is the big idea. The big idea is if you've been dropped on top of the mountain, it's nice, but how long are you going to stay there? Right, you're riding the waves of inspiration that are just coming to you from outside. It's nice, but it's not integrated. The stuff, the accomplishments that are born of our hard work and effort are the ones that, number one, are more meaningful and are meaningfully appreciated, and number two are the ones that actually last. That's why, for example, there's a big emphasis in Hasidic teachings put on the month of El preceding the high holidays. Yes, we can all show up in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and feel spiritually high. We listen to the shofar and we recite the prayers and we feel connected and we feel we're fasting in Yom Kippur, we're in white, and it's like a whole, it's a whole thing. You can feel uplifted. But that is an easy high, and it's easy come, easy go. And the day after Yom Kippur, you know, where are we? Are we right back down where we started? Because we were just riding the waves of inspiration, but are we still... But if we take 30 days before, take a month before El, and every day think about what it is that we're going to change about ourselves and improve about ourselves, not in a negative and depressed way, but in a positive, uplifting, you know, hopeful way, and think about what it is that we're going to implement in our personal relationships, in our relationship with God, in our connection with Torah study, etc. And we think about what it is that we're going to do better this year and how we're going to invest this year in a better year spiritually. Then we ride the waves and the inspiration on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. First of all, it's on a higher level. But also after that experience is over, you're left with something. You're not left with, this is my line, I don't know if it's been said before, you're not just left with a mashuv haruach umor hageshem, right? You're not just left with a blessing of rain after the holiday season. Because for some, that might be in the middle of the high holidays, at the end of the holiday of Sukkot, we change from asking for dew to asking for rain. The question is, if after the whole holiday season of Tishrei, if that's the only thing that's different, is that we change, we amend the prayers to ask for rain, is there anything different inside, or just like a liturgic differentiation? Is there actual substantive change? But there won't be substantive change unless we are paving the way for that change, unless we're doing something and investing in it. So the Rebbe says here, that yes, God could give us divine revelation. And historically, God did give us divine revelation. But it's, number one, it's not appreciated. What happens 40 days after divine revelation at Sinai? They're dancing the hora around the golden calf. Hava, nagila, hava. The menar, right? The menar. We spoke about golden calf last week, right? Mm-hmm. Yes? Okay. So that's what happens after Sinai. Great revelation. Okay, and yes, they did work for it also. They counted the Omer a little. But the point is that when you have something, a big high from above, from outside, something that is outside of what you've actually created, then it's not yours. And as soon as it goes away, you're not left with much else. And so, therefore, the efforts of exile, the efforts of working hard to eke out a relationship with God, to find God in the dark spaces of the earth, that actually creates a meaningful connection with God that is internalized, that we take with us and that we can build upon to get to a higher level in our divine service. And that's something that we're not ashamed to receive, because it's not really receiving as much as it is working for it. So here we have two understandings of what it means to work. Man was born to work. Number one, to make a living on a simple level. Number two, to experience a spiritual connection and to deepen one's spiritual connection. It also requires hard effort and hard work. Now, on, I believe it was the Rebbe's birthday, the Rebbe asked the following question. First of all, at this Fabrengen, if I am correct, it was at the Rebbe's 70th birthday, and the Rebbe talked about the concept of work and retirement. And the context was, he said, that people are encouraging him to scale back his activities. Right? He says, people are encouraging me to slow down. You're 70 now. You know, take it, be a little bit more, you know, calm it down a little bit. You don't need to be so active. Take it easy. Go on vacation. The Rebbe never went on vacation. Not one day of vacation. He visited the camps for like a few days. The overnight camp in the Catskills. He visited in New York. Once he became officially a Rebbe, the only time he left Brooklyn was to go to the Catskills for a short amount of time. And it was to visit the camp that he had established up there, the Gan Yisrael overnight camp. And aside from that, the Rebbe never took not one day off. Literally. I mean, just every day was working. And so people encouraged him, you know, take it easy, take a break, take a vacation.
Did he rest on the
Sabbath? Yeah, if you call Fabreng for hours on end speaking, and if you call that resting, then yeah, the Rebbe rested a lot. So the Rebbe said at that Farbrengen, it was also a Farbrengen, I think it was the same Farbrengen, where the Rebbe said that some people were wanting to nominate him for the Man of the Year. I think Time Magazine has Man of the Year, or had Man of the Year, or maybe it wasn't Time, maybe another magazine, like Man of the Year or Person of the Year. So the Rebbe said, I don't understand. If you are a mensch, right? Mensch, right? So then you should not just be a mensch for 1 year. You should be a mensch forever. And if you're just a mensch for 1 year, then what kind of mensch are you? So what is this Man of the Year? It doesn't make sense. Anyway, the Rebbe was smiling when he said that. The Rebbe said, not only am I not going to slow down, but I am going to put out a call right now on my birthday, the 11th of Nisan, to open up 70 new Chabad institutions around the world, which was a major jump in Chabad. So this was the Rebbe was born in 1902, so this would have been 1972. To call for 70 new institutions in 1 year, maybe today, you know, Chabad is so big, so it's a little easier. But back then, it was like a big call. And the Rebbe was like, I'm not slowing down. Then the Rebbe spoke about work, about this whole concept we're speaking about today. Why is it that God created the world in such a way that we need to work, and we need to work hard, and it's difficult to eke out a living, and everything that you want to accomplish, everything meaningful and everything significant requires a lot of effort, whether it's earning money or whether it's creating institutions and building a Jewish community and a global community, whatever it is. It all is the product and requires a lot of work. Why is it? And the Rebbe answered, based on what we just said in the second section of this class. And that is because God wants, because a person only appreciates that which they work hard for, so therefore God wanted us to appreciate things, so he made it that we need to work for these things. Then the Rebbe asked the clincher question. The question is found in text number 12. We'll do this quickly. Text number 12. Mike, please read this.
We cannot answer the question why God created the world in a way that we must work hard, because a person primarily enjoys the product of his own work. As the sage said, a person prefers a cob of his own produce to 9 cob of another's produce.
In other words, the Rebbe is saying we can't give this answer. We can't say that the premise of work is because, well, that's what we appreciate, so therefore God is kind of forcing us into a scenario to appreciate that which we earn. You can't say this why.
Ultimately, the rule of human nature is not of inherent necessity, but rather something that has been determined by God. If so, the question stands, why did God create man with the nature to specifically enjoy the product of his own labor, which involves difficulty and not something that is free?
In other words, if God is creating teva, if God is creating human nature, so why couldn't God have created human nature to appreciate and to enjoy and to connect with the handout, right? So God creates us to only appreciate what we work for, and then we have to work to appreciate it, and that's how we're in this cycle. So that doesn't answer the question. The question is, why did God create a world in which it requires so much effort to achieve that which is valuable? And the answer that we're trying to give is, well, because then it's meaningful. And the question on that answer the Rebbe is asking is, well, why is it only meaningful then? Because that's the nature of the human being. But who created that nature? God. God could have created human beings with a different wiring to disdain, to have disdain to the things that they work for and to enjoy the handout. God could have created a switch in human nature. And even if it doesn't make sense to us, but God could have created that where that makes sense, where that's logical. Yes. Yeah, but the question is, again, why, if God is creating the human being from scratch, if you will, right? So why didn't God create the human being with the nature to appreciate the free gift and to just be passive recipients in life? God should give us all the blessings, spiritual blessings of revelation, physical blessings of parnas, of a livelihood, without any work on our part. Then life would be boring and we wouldn't appreciate it and we would feel like we're just getting handouts, we would feel receiving bread of shame. So God could have created a different nature that we would appreciate what we get and enjoy what we're getting. Yeah.
Okay. I think, first of all, we forgot about the Garden of Eden. I think God created Adam.
Yeah.
And
they got kicked out.
You could really enjoy everything.
Right.
And we were punished, actually.
Right.
Because of eating the
fruit
of wisdom. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a God. So actually, work.
You're saying it's a punishment. It's the punishment. Yeah.
No.
Good. Good. No, it's a good. It's a good point. But we're trying to discover the blessing in the punishment, if you will. The blessing in the consequence. The understanding is like this: if something is coming as a consequence from Hashem, it can't just be punitive. It can't just be. We don't believe, or we at least we don't want to believe in.
That's a different midrash.
Well, no. It's that's the Torah. We don't want to believe. I don't think we want to believe in a God that's purely punitive, and saying, "Well, you did this. That's it. You're out. I'm going to get you, and now that you know you're in trouble." That's an ugly type of situation. The understanding here is, at least what we're trying to get to, is to understand how even that which seems like the curse is also for our benefit and has a positive side to it. So therefore, if we can explain a positive element to this whole paradigm, to this whole concept of work, then we're going to be more appreciative of what we have and work harder and achieve the blessing that we can achieve with it. We can take the punishment and turn it around to a blessing and reclaim Eden. We're going back. That's it. Forget about it.
Chapter 1, chapter 2 is that the first Adam was created in the image of God to create and to conquer, and the second Adam was created with the breath of God, and that is where the connection to faith and divinity is, so that there's this balance in each man and each woman between these two stories,
the two possibilities, if you will.
Well, within each of us, one is to do, and the other is to connect with God.
Right.
And you do to a point that you have to then reconnect with God, or always have God. You know, ideally, God is always there in everything you do, right? But that if you just are connecting with God all the time, then you are negating that other side.
Neglecting the work side of it.
The work side.
So, yeah. Let's finish off with the Rebbe's explanation about why it is that God created the human being, at least post-sin, why God created the human being with a sense to only appreciate that which they work for. And the Rebbe explains that it's because God wanted to give us the greatest gift, not just the gift of satisfaction and the gift of dignity, etc., but rather more so the gift of emulating the Creator. And in this way, being sent out of the Garden of Eden was the greatest blessing. Why? Because in a state, in a situation, in a scenario where Adam and Eve would purely be recipients of God's beneficence, where they would just be basking in the glory and in the bounty and in the beauty of the Garden of Eden, all of their needs taken care of without having to do anything. The garden is there. The trees are available. All you need to do is make sure not to trespass into that one tree and violate that. But otherwise, it's at your disposal. If that's what life is all about, if that's the extent of life, then it means that there is a radical, radical gap between Creator and creation, where God is doing the creating and we're doing the taking. God is making and we are just passively receiving. God is giving and we are passive actors on this stage. God wanted to give us the greatest blessing, the blessing of emulating Him. Just like God actively creates and produces and generates, God wanted to give us the gift of the same thing, to create, produce, and generate. So God says, I am not going to give you everything on a silver platter. You're going to have to work for it. And when you work for it, it's going to feel good. Why? At its core, why? Because you're emulating the Creator. You're emulating Hashem. We've all heard of the phrase, we are partners in creation. What does it mean, partners in creation? We are shutfin. We are partners in creation. It means that God created the world, didn't finish it. What do you mean didn't finish it? It's not perfect. Look around the world. There's a lot of imperfection. It's a real fixer-upper, this planet. It's a real fixer-upper. And you and I have been given a gift. The gift is that God says, I believe in you. Pick up a paintbrush, pick up a hammer, and make the world a nicer place. Make yourself more of a mensch. Make your family nice. Make your community nice, and make the world a better place. This grants us significance and meaning. If God created the world in such a way in which he was doing all the giving, and God could do all the giving. God gave and gave and gave, and all we did was receive. And then God created us, like the Rebbe asked, with the nature to love it and to not need anything more. Life would be good, but you know what it wouldn't be? It wouldn't be creative. It wouldn't be purposeful. It wouldn't be meaningful. Even if God created us in such a way in which it would feel good to us, and God could have created that it feels good to take, right? Could have created it with such a nature, but it still would have marked a massive gulf between God who's doing and us who are not doing. So God says, I want to give everyone the greatest gift, and that is the gift of significance, the gift of meaning, the gift of purpose. You're not going to just sit back, relax, and enjoy. You are going to make it happen. It's unbelievable how this notion has caught on so many different levels. I'm going to bring up another area, and we're going to close it in just 90 seconds. I'll bring up one more quick area that I imagine we're probably also not proficient in, right? Vegas, mountain climbing, and gaming. Any gamers? You're a gamer?
I play World of Warcraft.
Okay, so the holy grail of gaming today, right? The holy grail of gaming, and I use holy grail, right? The holy grail of gaming is to create a game in which the participants are co-creators in the game. Is to create a game where the person is not just playing in someone else's world and their arms are tied behind their backs and they can't really do much, but to create a game, to create an environment where you can build and you can create your own universe. The holy grail of gaming is to give people the tools that they can create their own stuff. Think about coding. It's that you can learn coding and you can create your own software. It's giving the tools in your hands. And God is the ultimate standard setter for this. God didn't create us in a way, at least post-sin, where we could just sit back and we don't have to do anything for ourselves. God says, no, you want to eat? Figure it out. You're going to have to work to eat. You want money? Figure it out. Go to work. You want a spiritual connection? Figure it out. You're going to have to work for it. Why? Because when we do this, we become like God. So I know in the 90s, it was cool to say, be like Mike. Be like God. Create a better world. Create a better world for yourself, for your family, for your community, and for, indeed, the entire planet. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.